Today's story is set aboard the brig Wanderer during the War of 1812 between the United States and Great Britain. During the war, the United States would issue a letter called a mark to a ship's captain after he applied for this, and that ship would be authorized to capture, burn, sink, or destroy any vessel belonging to the enemy. This way, the United States was able to increase the size of its quote-unquote navy by employing ships through this letter of mark. This ship and its captain became privateers. And privateers were basically legal pirates. They could, as we said, capture, burn, sink, or destroy British vessels. There's a great history of stories about privateers and privateering. It was very controversial, too, because they were not military aboard these ships. They were private vessels that were heavily armed and given this letter so that they could be privateers. So the Wanderer and their captain and crew are privateers, and we are going to hear about some of the tricks and tactics that they use. We are also going to travel along with Captain Wilcox, who we'll see has a very benevolent and noble heart. Shipmates, welcome back to the Sea Stories and Science Fiction Podcast. I'm your host, Malcolm Torres, and we have a great story for you today, Capture of an Indiaman. I'm excited to read this story for you because it's a real classic, as many of the others in this book, The Ocean Adventures by John Shelbourne Sleeper, published in the 1850s. We've seen this book is just a treasure trove of salty sea stories. Before we get started, I've got a couple of quick announcements. We've been going on the podcast now for over 30 episodes, and we've got quite a few people listening. But I would like to just ask you, please, wherever you're listening to this podcast, look at the app or the website that you're listening on. I'm sure there's a button there that says share. And all you've got to do is hit the share button, and it'll take you off to your Facebook or your Twitter or your Instagram account or LinkedIn or whatever you've got linked up there, and you can do a shout out. All you've got to do is put in there, hey, I've been listening to this podcast. It's great. You should check it out. And that will be like a avalanche, like a snowball effect. If I could get half of the people listening to this podcast to do that, we will multiply the listenership by 1,000, which is really what I need and what I would love to have happen. Because as you know, I'm a total nut for sea stories and science fiction. And just to get more listeners and to be sharing these stories would be just fun and exciting for me. So thank you so much for that. I would greatly, greatly appreciate that. The other thing, as I've mentioned a couple of times on the podcast, is I have some ebooks and some paperbacks of my own that you can find on multiple websites. There's the Apple iBooks app. If you have an iPad or an iPhone, you can find my books on the iBooks app. You can also find me on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Smashwords. I've got several novels that I've written, Sailors Take Warning, Sailor's Delight, and The Pirate. Also a selection of short stories called the Sea Adventure Collection. I've got several free stories on there. You can read the first 3, 4, 5 pages of them to get a sense of if this is the kind of story you'll enjoy. And now we'll just have a quick word from our sponsor and get on with today's story. Capture of an Indiaman, an adventure during the last war. It is well known, doubtless, that during the latest, and I hope the last war with Great Britain, an immense injury was done to the British commerce by American privateers and letters of marque. British ships were fallen in with on every sea. Some which were good sailors and well found and contained valuable cargoes were manned and ordered to some port in the United States. But the greater part of the captured ships were burnt on the waters where they were captured, after having been stripped of their most valuable articles. Such bonfires were often seen in the night on the Atlantic, on the Pacific, and on the Indian Oceans, and while they tended somewhat to cripple the resources of the enemy, they caused a vast amount of individual suffering and plunged many worthy men, who perhaps deprecated a war between the two countries as a great evil to be avoided at all hazards, from the summit of affluence to the lowest depths of poverty. Such have been some of the natural and unavoidable consequences of war. But we may venture to hope that such scenes will never be repeated, and that privateering will never hereafter be sanctioned by any civilized nation. In the month of August 1813, a beautiful brig called the Wanderer, of a Portland pilot boat model, was dispatched from a port in New England for the East Indies, with full permission to capture, burn, sink, or destroy any vessels belonging to the enemy which might be met with on the outward or homeward bound passage. It was thought, however, that the injury which this vessel would cause to the British commerce would not be very great, for she was far better calculated for sailing than for fighting. Her whole armament consisted of only 6 12-pound carronades, while 25 good seamen comprised all her effective crew. Nevertheless, the Wanderer made an imposing appearance on the water. She was a long, black, rakish-looking craft, heavily sparred, and ostentatiously exhibiting 9 portholes on each side. On the high seas, she would be easily mistaken by the enemy for an 18-gun brig, with all the customary means and appurtenances. The Wanderer was commanded by Charles Wilcox, Esquire, a man of great intrepidity and resolution, and who possessed, among other characteristics of a thorough seaman, a noble, generous heart. He was a strict disciplinarian, and although his crew were comparatively few in number, his vessel was managed with admirable skill and dexterity. On the outward passage, Captain Wilcox fell in with a number of British armed vessels, and was several times chased by their frigates and sloops of war, from which he found little difficulty in escaping. When he fell in with a large merchant ship, or a government vessel of small size, either of which would have been more than a match for the Wanderer, with her small armament and complement of men, he would hoist the stars and stripes at his trysail peak, and crowd all sail, steering directly towards her, with a drag astern to retard the brig's way, and preclude the possibility of getting within point-blank shot, while in any agony of fear the enemy would claw off with all possible despatch. The Wanderer was bound for China, and reached Whampoa after a short passage of 115 days. She succeeded in getting into port in spite of the British cruisers, which at that time were stationed at convenient intervals along the whole southern coast of China, and which succeeded in entrapping a number of valuable American ships and preventing others from leaving port. Her arrival caused quite a sensation among the British officers. An old Commodore Trenail, who arrived at Whampoa in the frigate Salamander a few days afterwards, declared with a knowing look, as he gazed with an admiring eye on the fair proportions of the beautiful brig, that although Jonathan had fairly weathered them by entering the port, yet he would find it a difficult matter to get out. Captain Wilcox anchored his brig apart from the other vessels in the harbor, and took pains to conceal the actual condition of his armament and crew. On shore, especially in presence of British officers, he talked large, and impressed them with the idea that the Wanderer was a crack privateer of 18 guns and at least 100 men. In the meantime, he was secretly purchasing his cargo of teas and silks, and by way of recreation caused a dozen Quakers or wooden guns to be manufactured on board and generally mounted on carriages or slides. He was thus enabled on gala days to show what appeared to be a formidable set of teeth, although the greater part of them were false ones. One day, Commodore Trenail, in a conversation with Captain Wilcox, expressed a desire to go on board the Wanderer. The Yankee was aware that the Commodore merely wished to satisfy himself with the efficiency of his vessel, and to form an opinion of the results of any contest that might take place between the American brig and one of the English gun brigs then in those seas. Nevertheless, without indicating by his manner any reluctance, Wilcox cordially invited the British officer to honor the Wanderer with his presence the next afternoon. Captain Wilcox went immediately on board the brig and had his Quakers put in good trim, and, sooth to say, they made an imposing appearance in their warlike garb, provided with Tompkins, aprons, breechings, gun tackles, and other trimmings. Cannon shot were arranged conspicuously in racks about the bulwark, and sabers, pistols, and boarding pikes in great profusion were exhibited in gallant array. Wilcox, who was seldom at a loss for expedients, next considered how he should make up for the occasion the deficiency of his crew, and finally applied to the captains of a few American vessels in port for the loan of their crews for a day. This favor was readily granted. The Wanderer was soon manned by some 80 or 90 as fine fellows as ever knotted a reef point or puddened an anchor. We had no chain cables in those days. And when Commodore Treenail came on board in his barge, agreeably to appointment, and passed up the accommodation ladder and over the gangway, and saw such a crew all neatly dressed at quarters, he promptly decided in his own mind that the Wanderer was calculated to do a great deal of mischief and would make short work with anything of less force than a sloop of war. He determined to take his measures accordingly. The result equaled the expectations of Captain Wilcox, who stood in as much fear of a small gun brig as of a frigate, but who was determined to avoid a contact with either and trust in the nimbleness of his heels. If he could only get fairly out to sea, an opportunity at length arrived. A furious squall set in during the night, the wind blew in fierce and fitful gusts, and the rain fell in great abundance and increased the obscurity of the atmosphere. Wilcox ordered the cable to be cut and, under a reefed foretop sail and jib, shot like a struck dolphin out of the harbor of Wampo. The Wanderer had a fine run to the Cape of Good Hope and met with nothing to furnish cause for alarm. One day, when a few degrees to the westward of the Cape, as day broke in the east, a large ship was seen steering to the eastward under the press of sail. Captain Wilcox altered the course of the brig and steered directly for the ship, which he soon made out to be a heavy East Indiaman, doubtless well armed and manned with a numerous and effective crew. All hands were piped to quarters. "Come, my lads," said the captain, "suppose we try the mettle of that fellow. We have taken nothing yet, and there is good picking on board some of these outward-bound Indiamen. The thing must be carefully done, however, for if John Bull only suspects our inferior force, he will blow us out of the water and laugh at us afterwards." Every rag of canvas was packed on the brig, and it was evident that the captain of the Indiamen did not like her appearance, for he tacked ship and stood off to the southwest. The Wander rapidly gained upon the chase and was fast closing on the weather quarter when Captain Wilcox fired a gun to windward and hoisted American colors. The ship replied by showing the British ensign and taking in her courses and topgallant sails. She was evidently preparing for a brush. Not a shot, however, was fired until the Wanderer was within hail, when Captain Wilcox sprang upon a gun near the gangway, with a speaking trumpet in his hand. He was a fine-looking fellow, possessing a dignified exterior, dressed in full uniform, and had a voice like a famous stentor of old. "First division there," he shouted. "See all ready to fire." And then directed his trumpet toward the huge ship, with heavy cannon protruding from her massy sides. He had the cool impudence to add in a loud and imperative tone, "Ship ahoy! Haul down your colors and lay your main topsail to the mast, or I'll give you a broadside." Then, turning to his crew, "Stand by, my boys! Take good aim!" Then, in his loudest tone to the Englishman, "Haul down your flag, I say, this minute, or I'll blow you sky high." This threat produced the desired effect. The British ensign came fluttering upon the deck, and the heavy main yard of the East Indiaman was reluctantly braced round, the helm was put hard down, and the ship was laid to with her main topsail to the mast, having struck to the United States letter of marque Wanderer. Captain Wilcox sent his first officer on board, accompanied by his clerk in officer's uniform, with orders to send on board the brig the captain of the ship, with his papers and as many of the crew as the boat could convey. The ship was proved to be the Alwick Castle, Captain Henderson, of 750 tons, from Bristol, bound to the Isle of France, with a cargo of stores, provisions, etc., of no use to the crew of the privateer. The ship mounted 16 18-pound carronades, and was manned by a crew of 40 men all told. The guns were double-shotted with round and grape, and one broadside, well directed, would have made fearful work with the Wanderer and decided the contest against her. But Captain Henderson was accompanied by his wife, a young and beautiful woman, to whom he had been married but a few short months. And to this circumstance must be ascribed his reluctance to engage in a desperate contest with a vessel apparently well fitted for fighting and evidently his superior. With a heavy heart, he handed the officer his papers and assisted his wife into the boat, and, with the greater part of the crew, they were soon on board the Wanderer. The men were placed in irons for greater security and temporarily stowed away beneath the Quakers in the waist. Captain Wilcox soon ascertained by examining the ship's papers that he had captured a prize of little value. He could not spare men sufficient to navigate her into an American port. Her cargo consisted of bulky articles which could not be transferred to the brig, and he issued orders to take out every man with all their baggage and set the vessel on fire. It was then that Captain Henderson ventured to remonstrate in a gentlemanly manner against such a summary disposition of property, in which he was directly interested, for he was a part owner of the ship and cargo. He suggested that, by burning the ship, his own ruin would be effectually sealed, without any benefit to his captor, and that, by restoring the ship and cargo to the legitimate proprietors, Captain Wilcox would perform a noble and magnanimous act, which would meet the approval of all good men, and which would be in accordance with the dictates of benevolence and justice. This was a view of the matter which struck a responsive chord in the bosom of the generous-hearted Yankee. There was force in the reasoning of the Englishman, and his feeling responded to the arguments set forth. He felt that it was little better than piracy to set fire to and destroy property belonging to private and deserving individuals when far away upon the ocean. But it is uncertain what would have been the result had he not at that moment caught the eye of the beautiful and accomplished Mrs. Henderson. She was sad but charming in her sadness, and addressed the captain in a musical voice, which sounded to him, accustomed for months to the gruff mutterings of the sailors, like the music of the spheres. He listened to her attentively, while in eloquent language she pleaded the cause of her husband, and Captain Wilcox, who with all a sailor's gallantry adored a lovely woman, was in his turn completely vanquished. He told her to give herself no further apprehensions. The vessel and cargo should be restored to her husband. Such was the triumph of beauty pleading in behalf of humanity and justice. In the meantime, the English sailors, who were stowed away among the wooden guns, were making observations and indulging in sundry philosophical remarks. "I say, Ben," growled a rough-looking tar with a voice like a screech owl, "just look at the cracking in this here gun." "Crack," replied Ben. "So there is. That gun was never cast in a foundry. It is made of a soft kind of metal and growed in the woods." "Aye," said another of the crew, "and here is one of the same kidney. Queer kind of cannon these Yankees use." "Cannon," chimed in the boatswain. "These cannon are all wooden ones. This craft has not an effective gun or board. All wood, all Quakers, as sure as my name is Timothy Twilight. We have been shamefully humbugged by these rascally Yankees." "This will be a pretty story to tell in England," resumed the boatswain. "The ship Alwick Castle of 16 guns, taken and burnt by a paltry Yankee merchant brig, armed with Quakers and manned by a dozen greenhorns, just out of the woods. And all this comes of having women on board. They are at the bottom of all this mischief that ever was hatched. For my part, I hate the sight of a petticoat." "Not worse than every pretty girl hates the sight of your bleary-eyed, squab-nosed, wide-mouthed, and hickory-barked phiz," replied with some tartness Jack Spendall, a young and handsome sailor with flowing locks and a bright black eye, "such as ladies love to look upon. A pretty woman is never out of place at sea or on shore, in fair weather or foul, and the man who grumbles at breathing the same air with a pretty woman is no sailor, and deserves to be kicked to death by marines." "That's true," Jack chimed in his gallant shipmates, and the boatswain was compelled to close his clamshell. Captain Wilcox went upon deck with Mrs. Henderson hanging on his arm. He ordered the crew aft. "My lads," said he, "you have behaved nobly. We have captured this British East Indiaman in a heavy force, without firing a gun, and she is a lawful prize of the Wanderer. But we cannot man her and take her into an American port, and therefore the ship and her cargo are of no value to us. Her captain is the principal owner of the vessel. He is a worthy man, although an Englishman, and the loss of his vessel will strip him of all his property and accomplish his ruin. His wife, whom you see here before you, has been pleading eloquently in his behalf, and I have promised that the ship shall be given up to the captain, with all her effects, with liberty to proceed on her voyage. What say you, my lads? Have I acted right?" "Oh," said Mrs. Henderson, stretching her fair arm towards a rough-looking tars, and addressing them in a melodious voice, "Oh, do confirm the promise which our generous captain has given me, and heaven will bless you." The sailor stared at the lovely woman with as much ardor and admiration as if she had been a superior being dropped among them from the skies, and when the captain repeated his question, "Have I acted right?" and was replied to by a ringing shot of "Aye, aye, sir," and "Three cheers for Mrs. Henderson." And the cheers were given with a hearty goodwill. Even the handcuffed Englishmen joined in them, with the exception of the boatswain, who was still looked sour and sulky under the rebuke of Jack Spendall. The Englishmen were liberated and conveyed on board their ship, which was given up to Captain Henderson. The parting between Captain Wilcox and the interesting couple, who had so unexpectedly honored his cabin by their presence, was extremely impressive. Captain Henderson expressed his gratitude in the warmest terms, and solemnly declared that he would repay the obligation the first time it would be in his power to serve an American citizen. As for Mrs. Henderson, words could not express her grateful feelings. Her sense of gratitude seemed in some sort to overcome her sense of propriety, for, when her words failed her, she threw her arms around the neck of the worthy Yankee captain and kissed him, much to the surprise and gratification of Captain Wilcox, who was subsequently heard to declare that the kiss lingered upon his lips for a fortnight. Even salt water could not wash away the taste of it. 2 or 3 years passed away, and peace was reestablished between two countries, which nature never intended should war against each other. Captain Wilcox was called to take the command of a fine ship in the East India trade. He sailed from New England, and in due time arrived at the Cape of Good Hope. On landing and reporting his vessel, he was asked if he was the same Captain Wilcox who commanded the brig Wanderer during the late war. "The same," replied he. "Then," said the officer, "allow me to return you my thanks for your kind treatment of our countrymen whom you captured off the Cape, and to whom you generously restored his vessel and cargo." He soon found that the story was well known at the Cape, for the Alnwick Castle had put into Table Bay after the vessels separated, and Captain Henderson and his fair companions were loud and eager in their praise of the generous-hearted Yankee captain. He was treated with great hospitality during his short stay at Cape Town. The governor showed him many attentions. Fetes were made and parties given for his especial gratification, and the ladies in particular welcomed him with their sweetest smiles. And all this for obeying the dictates of a generous heart, and refusing to act on the high seas in a manner more becoming of a lawless buccaneer or a pirate than in the member of a civilized and Christian community. The more he reflected on the course which he was prevailed on to adopt with great regard to the English East Indiamen, the better satisfied he was with himself. "What a ninny I should have been," said he to himself, "if I had set the Alnwick Castle on fire, with the flimsy plea of doing my best to cripple the resources of the enemy." He left the Cape of Good Hope and next touched at the Isle of France. After the ship was anchored in Port Louis, he started in his gig for the shore. A large English ship lay in his track, and as he drew near, he saw a lady beneath the awning of the poop, engaged in reading while breathing the grateful sea air. As the boat was gliding past the quarter, she raised her eyes from the page and gazed upon the features of the American captain. Her visage was instantly lighted up with an astonishment and delight. "Captain Wilcox," she said with eagerness. "Theodore, husband, there is Captain Wilcox," she repeated, looking down at the skylight. Then, running to the side of the deck, she snatched a scarf which was lightly reposing on her shoulders, and waving it towards the boat, attracted the attention of that gentleman, who recognized her now. In a moment he was alongside of the Alwick Castle. He was received at the gangway by Captain Henderson and his lovely wife. I hardly need to say that he was welcomed in the kindest manner. After the first warm greetings were over, Mrs. Henderson, with the agility of a fairy, descended into the cabin, which was elegantly fitted up, and returned on deck, bearing in her arms a bright-looking child about 2 years of age, who was indeed a miniature edition of herself. His name, she said, while her eyes were suffused with the tears of joy and gratitude, is Charles Wilcox Henderson. As Captain Wilcox stepped away over the gangway, after bidding his friends a temporary adieu, he was heard to mutter to himself, "What an unmitigated scoundrel I should have been to have burnt the Alwick Castle." Well, that was a nice sea story, don't you think, shipmates? Just always a fun game when you have sailing ships of war and the little stunts they pull on one another and the craftiness of the captain and, you know, even some of the camaraderie between sailors who are enemies of one another, the way they treat each other with some respect in port, and good-hearted Yankee Captain Wilcox allowing the other ship to go on its way, and then the whole turnaround at the end with the couple having named their son after the captain for letting them go. Just a well-written, very elegant, well-balanced sea story there. And you know, shipmates, we're up over 30 stories now on the podcast, and we've worked our way through all but one final story in the book Ocean Adventures by John Shelbourne Sleeper. And we'll have that story in just a few days, and that'll be the wrap-up for season one of the podcast. And I just want to thank you for joining me here. It's been really fun and interesting to work my way through these stories with you and get to know many of you online. And I've made a great many connections on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter with many of you. It's been nice exchanging messages and getting to know each other a little bit, sharing our interest in sea stories. And we'll be moving into season two, which is going to be primarily science fiction, maybe some horror, some crime, some weird tales. But there could be a few stories with a sea story tie-in in season two. So stay with us and look ahead to season two here after the next episode. As always, though, as I've asked, and I really need your help with this, is I would greatly appreciate it if you would give some shout-outs for the podcast. And also, I'd greatly appreciate it if you would head over to Amazon or Apple iBooks and look me up, Malcolm Torres. I have several books on there that are free and others for sale, ebooks and paperbacks, mostly sea stories and science fiction type stories. Your reviews on there are very much appreciated. And thank you very much. I'll see you in a few days with the next story on the Sea Stories and Science Fiction podcast. Farewell and following seas, shipmates.